Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining our conference today. Our conference will begin in approximately 4 minutes. Thank you for your patience. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by. Welcome to the Sia fourth quarter report conference call. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. Later, there will be an opportunity for questions and comments. Instructions will be given at that time. As a reminder, this call is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference call over to our host, Rhone Resch from Sia. Rhone?
Thank you, Terry, and welcome everyone. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. As Terry mentioned, my name is Rhone Resch. I'm President and CEO of Sia, which is the Solar Energy Industries Association. Sia is a nonprofit trade association representing a little more than 1,100 member companies across the entire solar supply chain, serving all market segments, including residential, commercial, and utility scale, and we represent all solar technologies. Today, we will be discussing the U.S. Solar Market Insight 2011 Year in Review. I'm pleased to be joined by Shale Khan, Managing Director for Solar at GTM Research, our research partner on the Solar Market Insight quarterly reports. Before we get started, though, let me quickly review the various types of solar technologies we'll be covering in our remarks today. Solar photovoltaics, or solar PV systems, capture and convert sunlight directly into electricity. Concentrating solar power refers to a number of different technologies that capture and concentrate the sun's heat used to power a standard power block generator to produce electricity for utilities, and these tend to be in the hundreds of megawatt scale types of projects. We are not covering solar heating and cooling in this report. This is another technology, solar panels that are used to generate hot water for homes and businesses. That is not covered in this report. However, this report shows that 2011 was a breakout year for solar. I'll let Shale go into depth with some of the highlights from the report and what we can expect going forward, but I wanted to take a few minutes to really set the stage with some of the high-level data points and what factors are really driving the incredible growth that we're seeing in solar today. The U.S. installed 1,855 megawatts of new solar capacity in 2011, far and away the best year for solar installations in a single year. This means that the industry will install an average of 5 million watts each and every day over the entire year, or 1 million watts installed about every 5 hours. And for the first time, the U.S. surpassed 1,000 megawatts in new installations for a single year. We are no longer talking about megawatts of installations. We are now talking about gigawatts of solar being installed annually. In the fourth quarter alone, we installed more solar than was installed for all of 2008 and 2009 combined. But we're just getting started. The U.S. is now poised to install more than 25 gigawatts of new solar PV between now and 2016. And the growth is occurring across the entire country, not just in California. We are seeing significant geographic diversification in this industry. Last year, 8 states installed more than 50 megawatts. In fact, 18 of the 23 states that we track in detail saw growth in 2011. Additionally, all 3 market segments, residential, commercial, and utility scale, had strong years, particularly the commercial and utility markets. We are seeing a shift towards larger projects as well. There were 28 projects installed last year that were sized at 10 megawatts or more. The year before, there were only 2. I could talk a while about all the great numbers in this report, and I'm sure Shale will have some more to point out, but I want to talk for a moment about what all this means and why we are seeing such strong growth. Since the federal investment tax credit went into law in 2006, we have had a 78% compound annual growth rate for installations in the solar industry over that time period. That's a 78% compound annual growth rate over that time period. Absolutely spectacular numbers. You know, those are numbers that we typically call Google numbers because they really represent the high-tech industry, and it's amazing to see a bricks-and-mortar industry like solar growing at that rate. The growth accelerated in 2009 with the 1603 Treasury program was created, which provided flexibility for when the ITC could not be monetized. State-level policies such as rebate programs and net metering are also opening up new markets where solar did not have access before, and the policies are working. In 2011 alone, the installed cost of solar energy came down by 20% for the consumer. and the price of solar panels fell by an astonishing 50% in 2011. Solar is now achieving a scale where it is significantly contributing to America's energy portfolio. The flip side is that we are seeing policy uncertainty potentially coming back to the solar market. Already, the 1603 program expired at the end of last year, and small businesses in the solar industry are being negatively impacted. I'm hearing from solar companies across the country that have already had to scrap projects and cut back on hiring, and in some cases, even laying employees off. We are seeing efforts to curtail market access policies in states as well, particularly with net metering programs across the country. And our biggest concern is in California, where there is a net metering cap that we will reach sometime in 2013. And unless that net metering cap is raised, it could have the impact of shutting down the industry later next year. So it is critical that the 5,600 companies that do business in the United States, that we don't face new uncertainties as we expand their operations. And we'll be working at SEIA to make sure we continue to open up those markets, addressing 1603, addressing the net metering issues in California, Massachusetts, and other places, to make sure that we have a stable and reliable marketplace in which to grow the solar industry. And the good news is that we have allies, both in Washington and across the country, who are ready to work with the solar industry. Just yesterday, 49 senators, led by Senator Stabenow, voted to extend the 1603 program. While unfortunately we needed 60 to make sure that this amendment was included in the transportation bill, we didn't get there. But again, having that strong support and continuing to push forward with 1603 on the transportation bill shows the commitment of our champions in Congress. It's going to take that level of engagement with policymakers, both in Washington and in state houses across the country, to make sure that solar is allowed to compete in our electricity marketplaces here in the United States. With that, I'd now like to turn it over to Shale for his take on today's report. Shale?
Thanks, Ron. It's a pleasure to be on another one of these calls and to be releasing this report today, which is really exciting for us. Once again, I'm Shale Khan. I'm the Managing Director of the Solar Program at GTM Research. And for those of you who don't know GTM Research, we're a market analysis, consulting, and advisory firm focused across the clean tech sector, but with a particular focus on the solar industry. And we've had this partnership with CF, through which we've been publishing these reports since mid-2010. And so this is the seventh edition of the U.S. Solar Market Insight Reports, the second edition of the annual year in review. And I'll just say, personally, you know, the solar industry in the U.S. just keeps getting more interesting to us. It also keeps getting more complicated and difficult for us to track, but that keeps us on our toes. So we're excited to be doing this, and I think Roan is right to state that the U.S. solar market had a really monumental year in 2011. And so what I'd like to do is just run through some of the key findings from the report, dive a bit into some of the numbers that Roan alluded to, and then add a few thoughts about the market's current outlook and where we see it heading over the next year or two, and then we'll open it up to Q&A. First, I think it's worth diving a little bit into the overall growth figures that Roan mentioned, since they were so impressive and it didn't occur in a uniform manner across markets and across states. So as Roan mentioned, the big top line number here is 109%. The U.S. solar market by installations for photovoltaics grew 109% in 2011 over 2010 and installed 1,855 megawatts. That's a big number. But apart from that, I think what's particularly impressive about it is the fact that that growth occurred everywhere. First of all, it occurred across market segments. We track three market segments individually, the residential market, the non-residential market, which is comprised of commercial installations, government, nonprofit, school installations, and then the utility market, which is generally larger systems, often ground-mounted, selling power directly to utilities or into wholesale power markets. And each one of these market segments grew in 2011. The residential market grew 11% year over year, and I think the biggest story there has been the growth of third-party ownership of residential systems, which enables homeowners to essentially have a solar project installed on their rooftop that they don't own, but they purchase either the power from or they sign a lease. This has drastically reduced the upfront cost, which was always the primary barrier to solar adoption at the residential level. In the non-residential market, we saw 127% growth year over year, a gigantic number, thanks in part to really big growth figures in California and New Jersey, the two largest markets in the country. The utility market saw the most growth, 185% growth from 2011 over 2010. Roan mentioned one, I think, really interesting way to look at that, which is how many projects over 10 megawatts are being completed. And as Roan said, we had 28 of those projects in 2011. We had 8 of them in 2010. We only had 2 in 2009. So we're really starting to see high volumes of large projects getting completed in the U.S., and the size of these projects is just getting bigger and bigger. I think 2012 should be the first year in which we have a project over 100 megawatts completed. That's a really big number, and there are a number of those projects still in development. Apart from that, I think, you know, another thing to look at is the quarterly numbers, because the fourth quarter of 2011 was by far the largest we've ever had in the U.S. We had 776 megawatts installed just in the fourth quarter. That's 115% growth over the same quarter in 2010. We, you know, have a growing market every quarter, so we expect to see bigger numbers, but that was particularly strong. And I think, you know, besides seasonal characteristics, there are a number of other reasons why the fourth quarter was particularly good, ranging from lower component prices to the looming expiration of the 1603 program, which I'll mention again in just a minute. Roan also mentioned the geographic diversification of the market, which has always been something that we are watching out for in the U.S. solar industry. It used to be that California was by far the dominant share of all installations in the U.S., and then a bit later it became California and New Jersey. And we're heading past that point where we have more and more states that are picking up meaningful amounts of solar demand, and as a result we have more diversity within the market. As Roan mentioned, 18 of the 23 states that we track in detail grew in 2011 over 2010. And in fact, we didn't used to track 23 states. We used to track 20 states. But as new markets pick up, we keep having to add new states because they are installing meaningful volumes. There were also 8 states that installed over 50 megawatts in 2011 individually. That's up from 5 in 2010. So we're getting a larger number of meaningfully sized markets. Finally, a last note on the installation volume, just another way to look at it. If your coverage area doesn't always include solar and we spend a lot of time talking in megawatt terms, another way to look at it is the value of the installations. So by our calculations, the value of all solar installations in 2010 was about $5 billion. In 2011, $8.4 billion. So even despite prices coming down and systems being cheaper and cheaper, the growth rate that we saw in installations still led to a much higher value for these installations. During the year, system prices fell on average, on a weighted average basis, 20%. And that was a mix of, I think, three primary factors that drove that. First of all, we had lower component prices. Panel prices in particular were falling really quickly throughout the course of 2011 as a result of the global oversupply situation. So that drove installation prices down. Beyond that, installation efficiency and economies of scale keep increasing, and so we're just driving down the costs outside of the panel and even in some cases outside of the hard component costs. And finally, a shift toward larger systems, which Roan alluded to and I mentioned as well. The larger the systems are, you know, typically the lower the price, and we had a big transition towards larger systems in 2011. On the manufacturing side, 2011 was a tough year. It was a tough year for solar manufacturers globally, and anyone who covers the industry will find this no surprise, because we ended up with the two largest markets in the world, Germany and Italy, having much slower demand years than was expected at the outset. And at the same time, manufacturing capacity was growing very quickly. And as a result, prices began to fall around March, and they didn't really let up until the end of the year. It created a difficult landscape that has resulted in various news items throughout the world, not just in the U.S. As a result, in the U.S., production of PV modules, which are panels, fell from about 1.3 gigawatts in 2010 to about 1.2 gigawatts in 2011. So really actually wasn't a huge decline. And our expectation is to see that number tick upward again in 2012. I think one thing that gets left out of a lot of these conversations that we cover in this report is panels aren't the only things that go into the solar system. There are a number of other components, perhaps most important of which would be the inverter, which converts DC electricity to AC. This is also a major component in solar installations, and the U.S. is actually becoming a much larger manufacturing center for inverters over time. Inverter manufacturing grew from 404 megawatts in 2010 to 615 in 2011. And a big reason for that is that inverter manufacturing, more so than panel manufacturing, tends to follow domestic demand. You set up an inverter manufacturing facility in any major market, and we've seen that in a big way in the U.S. as the U.S. market itself has grown. Just to finish off before we open it up to questions, a couple of notes on the outlook for the U.S. market now. In 2011, the U.S. installed 7% of all global installations. That may sound like a relatively small number, but that's up from 5% in 2010. And in fact, it's the highest market share of global installations that we've had in the U.S. since 2007. I think 2012, we're going to see the U.S. market share continue to grow, as well as the next couple of years, we should see pretty consistent growth, such that we're forecasting that by 2016, the U.S. market is around 15% of global installations. And at that time, the U.S. market should be in one of the top two slots for national markets. So the U.S. is certainly becoming more and more important from a global standpoint as far as where installations go in. In 2012, we're expecting another strong year with installations up around 2.8 gigawatts this year. I think there are a few factors that could drive that number in either direction, so it's worth noting those, and we'll be monitoring them throughout the year. The first is where panel pricing goes this year. It's still, to an extent, an open question, and this is really a function of global market dynamics. What happens in manufacturing capacity globally? What happens in major markets in Europe and in the U.S. and in China? And so, you know, there's a question as to how far panel prices will fall this year, or even whether they will continue to fall. A second major factor is the availability of project finance. This has always been one of the major, if not the major, bottleneck in the U.S. market, and it's certainly not going to be helped this year by the fact that 1603, the Treasury program, expired at the end of 2011. That creates a situation where projects are once again reliant on finding tax equity, which is a much smaller pool of investors than you would have if you don't require tax equity. Finally, state-level dynamics will play a major role. We have many legislative issues that are going to be taken up in various state legislatures and utility commissions in states like New Jersey and New York and California. These really are the nuts and bolts of the solar industry, things like net metering caps, things like renewable portfolio standards. They all exist at the state level, and they really enable and in many cases drive much of the demand that we see for solar. So these are going to be of vital importance to get these right in order to open the path for solar to keep growing in the U.S. So on the whole, we expect another exciting, interesting year in the U.S. solar market. We expect to see significant growth again this year, and we're looking forward to continuing to track it along with SEIA. And with that, let me hand it back to Roan, and we can open up the Q&A.
Thank you, Shale. We'll now open the line up for reporters' questions, and I'll turn it over to Terry, who will give you instructions on how to go about asking your question. Terry?
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question or have a comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. This will place your question in the order it was received. Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad now.
Thanks, Terry. I'd like to go ahead and exercise the option of asking Shale the first question, if I could. Shale, you know, you mentioned, we both mentioned kind of geographical diversification and how the industry continues to expand in other states outside of California, and in fact, New Jersey surpassed California this year with respect to non-residential, basically commercial installations, which is an amazing accomplishment. What other states, in your mind, had strong growth in 2011, and which states do you anticipate having that kind of growth in 2012?
Sure, that's a good question. I think one thing that I would note just to start is be careful about just looking at total installation numbers state by state in the U.S., because now we're getting to the point where we have these very large installations that can be completed in a given quarter or a given year and can drive the total for a certain state up very high, even if that state doesn't have a particularly vibrant market apart from these individual installations. So a good example of that would be New Mexico, which actually took fourth place in terms of total installations in 2011. That was largely on the back of a few utility-scale projects. New Mexico's residential and commercial markets are much smaller. So markets that I would say had a particularly strong year in 2011 outside of California and New Jersey, I would point primarily to Arizona, which had a strong year both in the residential market and in the commercial market, and New York to an extent, which actually has a pretty vibrant market as is and has the potential to be much larger in 2012 and beyond. The states that we are looking at for big growth for the next couple of years, let's start with New York. New York should see some growth anyway, but has the possibility to become one of the leading markets in the country if the New York Solar Jobs Act is passed this year, which would immediately turn New York into a New Jersey-sized market, which would be really valuable. Apart from that, Massachusetts has gained a lot of interest over the past couple of years and has introduced a pretty unique market mechanism to support installations. So we're expecting to see a fair bit of growth coming out of the Massachusetts market this year. And finally, Hawaii, which grew substantially in 2011, but I think we should see nearly a doubling in installations in Hawaii this year. Hawaii, of course, has really high retail electricity prices, which makes solar more attractive, but it also has some restrictions on solar penetration on individual circuits in some utility territories. And so as long as we can get around interconnection issues, solar in Hawaii is basically a no-brainer from an economic standpoint.
Great. Thanks very much, Shale. And just to point out in the report, when people look at some of the utility scale projects, New York actually had the third largest utility scale project in the entire country. So, again, these utility scale projects are not restricted to just the desert Southwest. You really can find applications in most states around the country. So why don't we turn it over to the reporters. Terry, we'll go ahead with our first question.
All right. Our first question comes from Nick Giuliano from Greenwire.
Good afternoon, Nick.
Good afternoon. Thanks for doing the call today. I wanted to ask, Roan, about you had mentioned the 1603 vote yesterday on the Stabenow Amendment. So with that off the table now, sort of, what are the next steps that you see? It seems like there's not really necessarily a vehicle for the rest of the year, maybe until the lame duck. But, do you guys have a sort of different view on that? And, what's that going to mean for the rest of the year?
Sure, thanks. There are a number of vehicles that we anticipate coming up between now and the end of the year. As you mentioned, extenders is one of them. I think with high gasoline prices, you could easily see an energy bill come up this summer. It's typical that you see an energy bill, sometimes smaller, but an energy bill come up in an election year. So we do think that there's a number of opportunities. And the thing I want to point out about 1603 as a program is that it really – I think benefits small businesses more than any other segment within the renewable energy industry, and solar in particular. The program helped finance 22,000 solar projects up to this point. And the average size of those projects were about $150,000. So, these are the kinds of systems that go up on schools, on churches, on community buildings. They're developed by electricians or kind of very localized developers. And so when, you look at a policy that supports small businesses that supports job growth and economic investment in the community, it's really hard to find one that is more effective than the 1603 program. So all of a sudden, that means that 1603 certainly has an application in a jobs bill, similar to the one we've seen in the House, and will come over to the Senate. But it also, I think, in an election year, is a very attractive program for job creation. Just so you know, we're looking this year at about 37,000 jobs that won't be created in the solar industry if the 1603 program isn't extended. So it is a pretty significant economic driver for an industry like solar, and we'll be doing everything we can to get 1603 passed as quickly as possible.
And what's your read on sort of the tax equity market that is the alternative to 1603? I mean, at what point do you expect that to, you know, sort of recover sufficiently that 1603 may not need to be there, you know, sort of over the long term?
You know, that's really dependent upon the economy itself, Nick. I mean, we have found that the tax equity markets are still about 50% short for renewable energy is what the market size is this year. So that shortfall will have a significant impact on solar, wind, and everybody else, you know, without a program like 1603. In the long run, when are those markets going to come back? It's kind of hard to tell. I mean, from a policy perspective, you'd want to put the 1603 program in place probably out through 2016 and then adjust it and remove it, you know, if the economy comes back. But the reality is, you know, for small businesses going to Wall Street to try to monetize the tax credit to help finance some of these solar projects is impossible. They're just not at a scale where Wall Street would be interested. You know, most of the banks are looking at $100 million projects or larger. So if you're a small developer and your projects are coming in on average at $150,000, you're getting left behind by the system. So the program like 1603, again, provides flexibility in how you finance these projects and really benefits small businesses.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Next question, Terry.
All right, our next question comes from David Baker from San Francisco.
Having the call this morning. I wanted to go into the stuff with California and the net metering. Give us an update on where that stands, getting that raised, and where are the utilities, the state's utilities, what are their positions on this at this point?
So right now, this is a recalculation request to the CPUC. We anticipate that they will be making a preliminary decision within the next couple of weeks, hopefully with a final decision in the second quarter. There inevitably will be a legislative fix as well, but as you can imagine, in any election year, it's difficult to get legislation passed. So we're not sure if we'll be able to get a legislative fix in 2012, most likely a 2013 initiative. And the utilities, you know, there's some working with us, some working not with us. And ultimately, you know, what we need to do is to address the concerns of the utilities with respect to net metering so that we can not just raise the cap a little bit, but remove the cap. You know, if we're already bumping up against This is the second time, the caps in California, and we did the same thing in Hawaii. You know, our goals of having solar become, you know, 10% of electricity generation or more are going to run into some significant impacts if we continue to have these market access restrictions. And so, you know, we're working with the utilities, but ultimately, you know, for the economy of California, it's critical that these caps get lifted by the CPUC as quickly as possible.
You know, what arguments are the utility industry pushing in Sacramento as to why the cap should not be raised?
None that are credible. You're going to have to check with them about specifically some of their concerns. But, you know, NREL and others have come out with studies that show at anything less than 40 to 50% of electricity generation, there is no instability. There is no grid concern. And, in fact, solar adds significant reliabilities to the electricity grid in California and in other high-use areas. So it's well, it's definitely a question that's well worth posing to them.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Thanks.
Thank you. Next question.
All right. Our next question comes from Edward Felker from Energy Guardian.
Hi. Thanks for holding the call. Can you expand on the job numbers a little bit in terms of how many jobs the industry created or supported last year, what you expect this year, and again, with the jobs that are at stake if you don't get 1603 extended? Thanks.
Thanks, Edward. We're going to take a shot at it, and then Shale, if you want to jump in afterwards. The Solar Foundation study that came out in October of last year showed that there are over 100,000 people employed by the solar industry in the United States. That is twice as many as were employed 2 years ago. So we've seen a very rapid rise in employment in the United States as the industry grows. As most of you know, solar creates more jobs per megawatt than any other energy source available. And so as you increase solar, you're creating not only manufacturing jobs, but sales jobs, accounting jobs, installation jobs. You're putting in place workers like electricians and roofers and many of the people who've been let go by the housing industry in this economy. We haven't seen the numbers for 2012 yet. I know the Solar Foundation is working on it. They actually do it. This is a census where they call companies directly. They don't just use a multiplier, which we've seen in the past. If you used a multiplier, the numbers would be quite a bit higher. So these are very credible numbers that come out of the Solar Foundation. What I would say, though, is we did do an analysis with EUPD Research to look at the jobs directly tied to the 1603 program. A one-year extension of the 1603 program would have created 37,000 additional jobs in the United States, just in the solar industry, so more in wind, more in other industries as well. So you're talking about 100 jobs per day that we're missing out on in this country by not extending the 1603 program. And I can't quite do the math, but we're probably somewhere around 7,000 jobs that have been, that we haven't created because of the inaction by Congress. I think, what's important, though, is really to look at these programs, not in the short run, but in the long run, that, we are building careers. These aren't just one-off construction jobs like you see for a pipeline that might be built in the middle of the country. These are careers where people are getting into the solar industry and remaining. And, when you start in the solar industry as an installer, in a couple of years you can be a line manager, in a couple of years you can be an owner, you really have a chance to create a career because these are small businesses. The vast majority of the 5,600 companies in the U.S. That operate in the solar industry are small businesses, and they have the ability to grow and add jobs and employment in this country much faster than large corporations do. So, again, the 1603 numbers are a direct calculation by EUPD, and we hope to see the Solar Foundation total employment numbers later in the summer as well.
Hey, can I follow up on that?
Yeah, sure.
How much uncertainty do you feel exists with the trade case with China over PV modules? And are you essentially looking forward to the future where manufacturing isn't so much of a job creator in this industry, but it's installations and maintenance, as you've been talking about?
It's a good question. I'll start off and then Shale, I'll turn over to you. I think one of the things that's important to point out about solar is people tend to think of the finished product, the PV module itself. And what you tend to find is that, those are assembled in various places, but the vast majority of the value that goes into a PV system is manufactured in different locations. So, for example, the U.S. is the largest manufacturer of polysilicon, the raw feedstock material that goes into solar panels. We are also the leader in innovation with respect to solar cell technology and high-efficiency cell manufacturing, which, again, could be assembled in the panels in other places. But certainly the IP and many of the manufacturing capabilities are here. And then certainly the United States is the leader in thin film, not only with First Solar and their manufacturing in Ohio and around the world, but also with so much of the innovation that's coming out of the West Coast with respect to different forms of thin film. So I think what's important to kind of say is, you know, the U.S. is a significant manufacturer today and will remain as such going forward in providing value into the whole solar manufacturing market, and that we shouldn't focus just purely on the assembly piece of it, which obviously we've seen grow in China significantly over the last few years. And, you know, I think based on the fact that you've seen Dow Solar build a huge plant in Michigan, and Hemlock expand their plant, and Wacker expand their plants, GE make an announcement in the United States, you're seeing a lot of investment come back to the United States with respect to manufacturing. So I think that trend will continue. We will not be the largest assembler of modules in the United States, in the world, but I do think you're going to see a lot of manufacturing jobs, research jobs, and very strong innovation occurring here in the United States, in addition to the job growth in the installation side. Shale, do you have other insights you want to add?
Sure. Just first, I guess, to follow on Roan's point there, you know, the other point to make is beyond just there being earlier steps in the value chain in the production of a solar panel, there are also components outside of the solar panel that are just as important to the project itself. I mentioned before inverters, and inverter manufacturing in the U.S. is actually growing, as is the balance of systems, things like racking and mounting structures. These are things that typically you manufacture close to the site of installation, or at least domestically, because shipping costs end up being high relative to the cost of the component itself. So there is an additional point to make, which is that to the extent that the U.S. continues to grow as an end market for solar, we will see manufacturing of those types of components continue to gain steam. Apart from that, you asked about the trade case, and I can't speak to how that will impact job numbers, but you know, it does create a lot of uncertainty around the market. We'll start to get more clarity over the next couple of months. We'll see the first preliminary determination next week, and that's going to quell things just a little bit, at least in terms of providing clarity. But, you know, certainly any time that you have the potential for an import tariff of unknown size on some portion of the components used in a significant share of systems in the U.S., you obviously have introduced uncertainty. The hope is that uncertainty will go away as quickly as possible, and we can get back to having at least a clear path forward for the solar market in the U.S.
Great. Thanks, Shale. Next question, Terry.
All right. As a reminder, if you'd like to ask a question or have a comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad at any time. Our next question comes from Chris Hawley with the Energy Daily.
Hey, Chris. Good afternoon.
Hi. How are you, Ron?
Good.
Some reporters keep asking my questions as rapidly as I dream them up. My latest effort, however, I believe Shale mentioned a number of expecting about 2.8 gigawatts of installations this year. And I guess I'm trying to understand how that level will be achieved if we don't get some sort of solution with 1603. Roan, you said that much of the growth was in these non-residential, non-utility sector, which relies heavily on the monetization of these tax credits through the Treasury grant program. If that is not available, how do these smaller but not smallest projects get financed?
I can take a stab at that, and then Roan, feel free to jump in as well. I guess the first point to make here is that the impacts of 1603 on installation numbers are going to be felt a bit later. The reason for that being that in order to qualify for 1603, you didn't necessarily have to have completed your project in 2011. You just had to either begin construction on it, or you had to have basically spent 5% of the total system value on components.
So
what we ended up
pipeline.
Yeah, so there's a big pipeline of projects that did qualify for 1603 that will be built out this year, and so installation totals should still be pretty strong. The time when we're going to start to really see the impact of 1603 on installations will probably be beginning in late 2012 and then extending into 2013.
I see.
Yeah, and, you know, again, the emphasis I would make is on a point I made before, which is that 1603, the lack of 1603, disproportionately impacts small businesses. And although they may not make up the lion's share of the total installations in this country, we think they're a very important part of our industry and for our economic recovery as a country. So, you know, I think when you look at the scale and some of the larger projects, as Shale has pointed out, those numbers will continue to grow. But ultimately, the problem is still it still exists that the tax equity markets are not back and are not as large as they need to be in order to support renewable energy growth in this country.
And Ron,
Chris, yeah, go ahead.
Ron, if I could just ask a quick follow-up about this net metering cap. This device is used typically by PUCs to ameliorate utility concerns that rapid installations of solar will somehow disrupt the grid? Is that the underlying premise of net metering caps?
I think historically that's the case, is that it's part of an agreed-to settlement initially for either an RPS or a program like the California Solar Initiative. But, you know, it used to be 3%, now it's 5%, and again, it really depends on the way it's calculated. I'm happy to follow up with you afterwards, Chris,
okay,
to go through
that'd be
a
great
little more detail on it, because
yeah,
the California thing is a little bit, you know, I just don't want to bore people on the call.
Sure.
There's a lot of subtleties to it, but ultimately, you know, I think these concerns or these programs were put in place when there were concerns before we had the data about what you know distributed generation would do to the grid, and now that we have, you know, just boatloads of data and analysis from research labs and, frankly, from utilities themselves, they see it's not a problem. And I think Hawaii is the classic example where, you know, they have raised and removed their caps completely in order, you know, because there's no concern about grid stability. And subsequently, you've got the opportunity for the industry to grow. And you know, I think the thing I want to point out about net metering and not to sound you know, kind of to 10,000 foot kind of philosophical here, but, you know, this is about competition. This is about the free market system starting to work. And, you know, when you have a government-protected monopoly, they're going to fight pretty hard to protect that monopoly and to limit the amount of competition that can exist. And so we have a challenge as the solar industry, because we're taking on this established government-protected monopoly and trying to gain access to the electricity marketplace. But the good news for the consumer and, frankly, for electricity stability is that having more competition, having more solar in a distributed form not only stabilizes the grid but provides a lower-cost option for consumers. And so as we look at how we want to rethink our electricity generation in this country, improving our energy security and our domestic resources, competition is an important part of that mix. And net metering right now becomes a major barrier towards increasing competition in our electricity marketplace. So, you know, this in large part, it becomes about property rights and about your ability as a homeowner to generate your own electricity. You know, and this is a little bit of a battle that's going on in Georgia as well, but a very important one for us as a country to be taking on. So thanks for raising it, Chris. Next question, Terry.
All right, our next question comes from Tim Glass with the Tucson Sentinel.
Hey, good morning, Tim.
Hi, thanks for taking my call this morning. I'm curious about solar leasing, the third-party ownership option, and what is the future of that? I believe Shale that probably contributed to the 11% of the residential growth last year, and how does that for the future?
Sure. So the residential third-party ownership model, which is what we generally call it because that incorporates both residential leasing and then a residential power purchase agreement model, I think it still has a long way to go. That model has been available in the commercial market since 2005 or so, and it's really only been available in the residential market since 2009. And even within that, it's taken some time for the economics of projects to get sufficient so that that could be introduced in more state markets. So initially it was just California, and then it's been growing. So we're still, I think, in the early days. It fundamentally is a really attractive customer value proposition to eliminate the upfront cost and often have a fixed payment or a pretty well-known payment on a monthly basis. So it makes sense that I think that model has been taking off by such leaps and bounds in markets where it is introduced. But we still haven't really penetrated all of the state markets. We also haven't penetrated all of the available residential rooftops. And so my inclination would be to say that that model is going to see substantial growth over the next couple of years. And it's really getting to the point now where most major residential installers have access to a third-party leasing platform, either by doing it themselves or by partnering with a company that provides financing. So I think it's you're going to continue to see growth there. We won't ultimately hit a point where every project is leased, just like we haven't in the commercial market. But I think there is still quite a ways to go, particularly in introducing and growing that model in new states.
You know, what I would add, Tim, this is Roan, is that this is a fairly new model, and as Shale pointed out, it's really made a rapid impact into the residential marketplace, and obviously PPAs in the commercial marketplace are significant. The innovation that's occurring in the United States is not just on the technology side, it's also on the business model side. And I would argue that residential leasing and other structures will continue to evolve. And you will see new business models that are true innovations be brought to the solar industry that may be a more sophisticated structure. So I agree with Shale. I think they're here to stay and will be a larger part of the market going forward.
Is it a fairly equal national trend? I mean, do you see it developing rapidly in all the states, or is it taking off more in some sense?
Well, it's really a function of what states it can be introduced in. I think fundamentally the barrier that most third-party leasing providers face is if you want to introduce a third-party lease product in a new state, you want to be able to offer customers savings from day one. And so that means the economics of the system have to work out right, which is generally a function of state-level market dynamics. So it's not uniform across states, largely because the option isn't available in every state yet, and in some states it's only available from one or two providers as opposed to six or seven or eight. But in the states where it does get introduced, it has almost always grown by leaps and bounds very quickly. You saw this happen in 2010 in Colorado when it was first introduced, immediately took off, and that's happened, I think, in a number of states since then. So it's not uniform across states, but once it gets introduced in a state, it immediately picks up, typically.
Thank you.
Next question, Terry.
All right. To ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad at any time. Our next question comes from Gloria Gonzalez with Environmental Finance.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. I actually wanted to follow up on two of the statistics that were mentioned early in the call. Roan, I believe you said that you're expecting more than 25 gigawatts of new capacity between now and 2016. Is that PV capacity?
That's a combination of both PV and CSP. But if you go to the back of the Solar Market Insights report, you'll see a breakdown of specifically what we anticipate occurring between now and 2016 with respect to PV.
Okay. And, Shale, I think you said that you were expecting a 100-megawatt project to come online. Is that this year or next year?
We should start to see a few multi-hundred megawatt projects coming online over the next couple of years. Once you get to projects of that size, typically they come online in increments. So, for example, Sempra Generation has a 150-megawatt project that is in construction. 42 megawatts of that came online in 2011, and we should see the rest of it come online this year. So that will ultimately be a 150-megawatt project. You could also point to Agua Caliente, which is a 290-megawatt project, of which 30 megawatts are already operating. So these multi-hundred-megawatt projects, we'll see the first of them actually operating this year, but some of them, especially the biggest ones, the 500-megawatt projects that are in construction, those will take a few years to build out, and they'll just be connected in 30 or 50-megawatt blocks.
Thank you.
Hey Gloria, my apologies. I was looking at a chart here trying to answer your question. That 25 is just for PV. CFP will be on top of that between now and 2016.
Okay, great. Thank you.
All right, our next question comes from Frank Andorka from Solar Power World.
How you doing?
Hey, Frank. Good afternoon.
I just had a question for you about the Senator Bingaman's Clean Energy Standard Act of 2012 and what effect you think that could have on both the whole issue of smoothing out the state's clean energy requirements and what effect that might have on the 1603 going forward.
Thanks, Frank. Great question. For those of you who don't know, Senator Bingaman reintroduced his clean energy standard, which would create a national approach towards clean energy, not just renewable energy. And his standard kind of ramps up over time, fairly similar to the administration's approach that was outlined last year in the State of the Union. Having said that, though, as you know, Senator Bingaman is retiring this year, and so there's limited opportunities for getting the CES passed. We don't anticipate it being a standalone bill. I've spoken to Senator Bingaman several times about this. Unless there is a very aggressive push to put an energy bill in play and to shift towards clean energy, and again, this is natural gas, clean coal, nukes, and all renewables, we won't see it pass this year, to be honest with you. So I think there's limited chance of passage. It doesn't quite have the support that it would need to move forward, and it'll probably be another year or two before Congress takes a swing at a national approach towards clean energy.
Thank you.
I don't want to dismiss it, but unfortunately, that's the reality of where we are. Thanks for your question, Frank.
All right, at this time, we have no questions waiting.
Okay, great. Well, thanks, everyone, for taking the time to be on this call and for asking your questions. I always enjoy these calls because I hear a lot about what you're thinking about and kind of the discussions we have are always educational. I get to hear more from Shale and everything he's doing, which is amazing. So really appreciate everybody for dialing in. Going forward, if you have any additional questions that you didn't get a chance to ask or want to ask us kind of more directly, please contact Jared Blanton, who's with SEIA, and he can be reached at 202-556-2886. With that, I want to thank everyone once again for joining us today, and just want to leave you with this one final message that, you know, although this isn't a dog bites man story, it's okay to write a story about a good news story about the solar industry growing in this country because it is something that people really like to read about. We're not only creating jobs but economic opportunity, and in our opinion, this is an indication of where we're headed as a country towards cleaner energy. So we look forward to working with you to help finalize your stories if you have any additional questions, and I want to thank everybody again for joining us. Have a great afternoon.
Ladies and gentlemen, this will conclude our conference. Thank you for joining us today.